with me tonight, beloved, to the Gospel of Matthew once again. The Gospel of Matthew in chapter 5. We've been studying for some time now in the Beatitudes. And it appears that we are to our next to the last session on the Beatitudes, since there's 8 Beatitudes. And tonight we'll be looking at the 7th one. Would you begin with me, beloveds, at verse 1? And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was seated, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth, and he taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then he told them why. Theirs, and theirs alone, is the kingdom of God. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those that do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart. That's the one we looked at last time. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And then verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they, and the pronoun once again is emphatic in the Greek, they and they alone shall be called the children of God. Blessed are the peacemakers. For most of you here, I'm sure that you have experienced in your life a need for peace and a lack of peace. And so, welcome. You've come to the right place. Because tonight we're going to talk to you about what God means here, what He's talking about, what kind of peace He's talking about when He tells us, Blessed are the peacemakers. Very difficult for a teacher to stand up and begin to talk to anyone about blessed are peacemakers. We all have problems with interpersonal relationships between ourselves and our spouses, ourselves and our parents, ourselves and our bosses, ourselves and our employees, between ourselves and our friends, and our other relatives. And it's very rare that many of us have met with very much success in our own lives of being a peacemaker. Most of us probably have been pretty frustrated throughout most of our time as a peacemaker. And it's difficult as a teacher to stand before you and try and cast some idea, some image, that I'm a perfect peacemaker and therefore I'm qualified to teach the lesson, since we never have any problems at my family because I'm such a perfect peacemaker. God has ways of humbling us, and always seems to come just before you try to teach something dealing with peace. I want you to understand, the Bible's got... peace is one of the greatest themes in the whole Bible. The Bible opens with peace between man and God in the Garden of Eden. And the Bible closes with peace between man and God in the New Jerusalem, on the New Earth, and the New Heavens. The problem isn't there. The problem is everything in between, which is where you and I live. There is no peace now as compared to where it opened and where it closes. We all know that. Naturally, there's no peace. Satan and his angels have rebelled against God, the Creator. Man has rebelled against God. We have inherited from our ancestor Adam a rebellious nature. We don't want to do what God says, and we don't want to do what anybody else says. And we all, except what few times we either walk in the Spirit or walk in fear, only do not exert rebellion. To some sort of gain on our own for our own purposes. See, that's not real peace. It isn't real peace at all. I want you to understand that God is not at war with the fallen angels or with fallen man. That's not why we don't have peace. The problem is, Mark, that the fallen angels and fallen man are at war with God. And it's hard not to be in a war when the other guy wants to fight. I want you to understand that peace, the word peace and the word truce, aren't the same. They're not synonyms. So I'm glad you're here tonight because I want to talk to you about peace and being a peacemaker, not in setting up truces. I'll elaborate on the difference as we go. Unfortunately, I fear that most of us are only familiar with truces. And I think I ought to begin by defining what the Bible version of peace is, what the word peace means biblically. It's really simple. It's uncomplicated and totally non-theological. It means peace with God. In other words, it really won't fit the definition on the street. It won't fit the definition that the news media understands. The majority of the people that are in leadership positions in communications, be it radio, television, or magazines, newspapers, very few of them really believe in the kind of God we're talking about in the first place, if they believe in any God at all. See, what I'm getting at is once we have individually peace with God, then and only then can we experience peace with ourselves. So what I'm trying to tell you is, if you're in here tonight and you don't have peace with yourself, the reason is you haven't got peace with God. That's the first step always. We don't usually see that and perceive that as being the case when we're in the middle of the stew. We see the other person, the fool, the opponent, the wicked one. This can be your child, wife, mother. You know, whoever it is that isn't wise enough to see that you're right and that I'm right. As I remember seeing it one time long ago and liked it so much, I inculcated it into my vocabulary. I can always tell when I've met a well-informed person, their views usually coincide with mine, you know. And, you know, when you're arrogant and proud and lost, that sounds great. And we laugh. We laugh because we understand that. We have practiced it, and we know people that, you know, are Christians who still haven't given up on that. And we know a lot of lost people that may not know that little saying, but they practice it. I want you to understand that peace, as we find it in the Bible, is not just the absence of conflict. It's not just the absence of strife, and that's what most people think when they think of it. If you go to the cemetery tonight, you will find no conflict, no strife. But, beloveds, that's not what God had in mind. It's not what I've got in mind when I talk about peace. Do you hear what I'm trying to tell you? I'm trying to, you know, get you with me about understanding that we're not talking what we're not talking about so that we can understand what we are talking about. Because many of us, we're in here tonight, And we've had some conflicts at home and conflicts at the office. And what we're thinking about when it talks about being a peacemaker is not what you brought with you to the study tonight. That's what I'm trying to get you to see. All right? Good. See, peace, as the world system understands it, simply means and carries with it the connotation is we've stopped to reload and rearm. Okay? I have stopped because I can't think of anything else to blast you with. But once I have time to mull over what you've said, I'm ready for my rejoinder, my yeah but. Okay? And this goes about in all levels of our dealing with people. In a governmental, international level, that's what peace means. We've stopped. And this is actually what I mean by the word truce, because it isn't real peace. See, the proof is, we just reload and later we have another conflict. You got it? Good. So Bible peace, I want you to understand then, means that the issue is settled. The parties involved, hear this, embrace. It's different. Oh, it's getting quieter. I want you to understand then that what I'm saying is that Bible peace is not the absence of something. The absence of strife. The absence of conflict. Bible peace is the presence of something. And that presence is the presence of righteousness. That, beloved, we've brought it up over and over in this study. The problem is that God is righteous and we aren't. In the garden, Adam and Eve lost the big R. And it's only when righteousness is present that we feel comfortable with God. That's one reason why we really don't want to see God face to face. You may think you do. You don't. Not yet. When He finishes with us and has transformed us into the image of Christ, that's a different story. But right now, tonight, if Jesus appeared to me alone, I would feel much like Peter did in Luke 5. I would fall on my face and say, "Depart from me, for I am a sinner." I wouldn't feel comfortable. And God knows that. And He doesn't want us to have that. So He's working on it. See, some of you think, well, if God's really there, you know, that's what we all said at one time and what all our lost friends still say, why didn't He just pop out there and appear? And the answer is because it'd scare the hell out of you, buddy. It'd scare the bejuniors out of you. And God doesn't want that. How do you know that, Floyd? Because when Adam and Eve sinned, after having a close personal relationship with God where they walked and talked with Him in the cool of the evening in the Garden of Eden, they immediately hid. There was a barrier between them, and that barrier was the barrier of sin. It was the barrier that resulted when they lost the big R. They were no longer righteous. They had a nature that was foreign to the nature of God all of a sudden. That the thoughts and things of God just didn't seem like a lot of fun. And so I want you to understand, beloveds, that it's the presence of something. And that presence is only achieved by God Himself. And that's worth coming to hear. Lest any of you fall into the self-deception of thinking that you can, in and of your own efforts, make yourself righteous. What we need is for the potter to work on the clay. Would you turn quickly to Matthew chapter 10? And let's look together at a verse so that we can begin to deal with what God is saying to us about this peace business, the kind that he's talking about, which is different from what we came in here with tonight. Would you look at verse 34 with me, beloveds? Jesus is speaking. Think not that I am come to send peace on the earth. I can't believe he said that. I thought he was the Prince of Peace. Isaiah 9:6. He is. But he says here, think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. As you continue studying the Scriptures, you'll find out that's not a sword made of steel. Not yet. It soon will be. But the two-edged sword of the Word, that's why I quoted to you Hebrews chapter 4, verses 12 and 13, as we began tonight. So, Jesus made it clear in the garden when they came to arrest Him, before they left, when they had had the Lord's Supper. He says, okay, gang, let's go down to the Garden of Eden, to the Garden of Gethsemane and have a little prayer meeting there so I can be arrested. By the way, be sure and bring some swords. And they said, well, we've got a couple. That's enough. That'll get it done. That'll be enough for even dumb Floyd to understand. There in Houston, Texas, in 1990, on a Tuesday night, at a Bible study. So when they came to arrest him, Simon Peter did just exactly what Jesus knew he would do. Because he knew Peter. When they came to arrest him, he pulled a sword and swung, obviously trying to cut the guy's head off. I'll say this, at least he was brave enough to draw a sword. But I don't know about you, but if I was going to be defended, I'd like to be defended by someone that knew how to use the sucker. He missed and cut the guy's ear off. And Jesus, in effect, said, perfect. Thank you, Peter. You got the point across to Floyd. We really only needed one sword for this job. You did it. Now, put that one up. So that you and I would understand that the sword he meant was the two-edged sword of the Word of God, and not the sword of steel. Now, beloveds, from this verse, I want you to clearly see that verses, God has written the Bible so that unless you see the context and the timing, you and I will always be left on the horns of a dilemma, appearing that God has contradicted himself. Is he the Prince of Peace? Or is he the prince that brings the sword to divide? And the answer is absolutely both. The first time he came saying, here I am, choose. The next time he comes, he will bring a sharp two-edged sword of steel, and by conquest, he will cause peace to those who would not yield any other way. You know, that's what has to happen sometimes to people that won't yield any other way. There has to be force. There has to be a final determination. So you can see from this verse that Bible peace is not peace at any price. That's what we're talking about. Because, beloveds, you can never have peace, Bible peace, at the expense of the big R. Righteousness. Some of you, in dealing with your situations at home, I'm trying to encourage you tonight. You've got problems with your children, problems with people that you know, and some of you are trying to solve these difficulties, these conflicts, by peace at any price. Some of you men in your relationships with your wife, peace at any price. Peace so that at 10:30 everything's okay. But peace at any price is not Bible peace. Peace at any price, among other things, is coercion. Peace at any price, and always it will involve, beloveds, if you try it, the compromise of God's principles.
don't, you know, I hear people say, for me to do that, I would have to compromise my own principles. Who gives a fig? I don't care anything about your principles or my principles. Unless they just happen to coincide with the principles of God. And so what I'm trying to tell you, beloveds, is there is no peace when you compromise the principles of God. For example, Jesus has told us two direct commands, and they seemingly are contradictory. He has told us that as we go into the world, tell everyone the gospel of peace, the gospel of Jesus Christ, tell everyone. Teach them and make disciples. He has also told us, watch out. Do not cast your pearls before swine. He was good enough to tell us why. Because they will ignore it. They will count it as mung, that's green slime, in the ice machine. For those of you that don't understand that, watch Marvin Zindler on television and when he gives the restaurant reports, and he will tell you that certain restaurants failed the food test, the drug and everything, because there was slime in the ice machine. That one always makes me want to eat at home. Well, which are we going to do? He says, they will turn on you and trample you under feet and rend you, tear you apart. And most of us in here that have ever witnessed, evangelized for the Lord, one-on-one, we've had some of that one happen to us. You really got to walk in the Spirit to know when to keep your mouth shut and when to give the gospel. And so I'm trying to show you that no matter what our intentions are, the best intentions of trying to bring someone to a point and place in their life where they have peace with God, well, you just got thrown in the frying pan quite often. And as a result, sometimes we wonder if we're really peacemakers. Well, let me hasten to add that the motive of our heart is also part of that. Quite often we may tell someone what we think is the message of God when the truth is we're trying to burn them. We're trying to win the argument. We're trying to put that evolutionist in his place. Instead of getting him out of the place that he's well on his way to, quite possibly. You see what I'm saying? And so, beloveds, there can be no real peace. No real peace if the big R is ever compromised. As we try to make peace with God for ourselves and to be the peacemaker on God's behalf by giving the gospel to others. Otherwise, we have a truce. Let me tell you what I mean by a truce. Truce is a ceasefire. But again, all we're doing is reloading. Truce, that's a cold war. That's what we have a lot of times at home at night when she turns and grabs that blanket and grabs that pillow and yanks it and rolls that shoulder, and you can just hear her pop that pillow with her hand, pop, pop, and sound asleep she goes. Okay, that was a cold war. Okay, that means we're not going to scream, we're not going to shout, and we're not going to fist fight. But it's not peace. And we've all seen movies where people did that. And television programs. So what I'm saying is, quite often, before we see or experience the peace we're trying to accomplish in the name of the Lord, what we really see is just what Jesus promised here in Matthew 10:34. A sword, strife, contention, anger. And we leave quite often, if our intentions were right, frustrated, not understanding, wondering how we ran into that sausage grinder. And I'm trying to encourage you that, yeah, I know. When you do what God says and try to make peace, you're laying your life on the line. Whoever said Christianity was easy lied to you. I want you to understand, therefore, beloveds, that the gospel is contentious. It's called in the Scriptures the gospel of peace. And it is, because the object of it is to make peace between God and man. Because God has done everything necessary to bring peace to these rebels. But it brings contention with self, big ol' I. And it brings contention with others. It brings about, it ruffles feathers. It brings division and strife. And there's no one here that's tried at all to let the Spirit of God lead you that has not experienced it. I'm trying to make you understand it was normal. Don't look in the mirror tomorrow morning and say, I fail God, or I'm a freak. Or I bet Floyd would have known just what to say. I want you to understand. You know, a lot of you guys, listen to me. Yes, I do know the Scriptures. No brag. It's just a matter of I have pored over them for years. You can't bring something up in this book I don't know about. I may not be right about it. I may not understand it. But if it's in this book, I know about it. You're not going to come up and tell me some story and say it's in the Bible and it not be there and me not know it. Okay? But if you think that means that every time I witness to people and talk to them about their souls, that I get 100% results, I'm not batting 500 even. Are you? And if you are, you come up here and teach a while. It ain't even close to that. And so I want you to understand that some of you, you're blinded to thinking that, well, they asked me such a good question that if Floyd was here, he'd know the answer to that, and that would solve it. No, it wouldn't. Knowing the right answer doesn't make people accept repent of their sin and accept Jesus. At all. They're two totally different concepts. And besides, I might not have known the right answer anyway. I can remember one time being confronted in El Paso when I was teaching on science and the Bible by a young engineer who thought he had a devastating question that there was no answer for that would prove that everything I was teaching was a bunch of junk. He got his young wife to intercede on his behalf for an audience with me. And I was tired. My voice was gone. I didn't want to see anybody, and I didn't care if the whole world went to hell. I wanted to go to bed. Now, that's how spiritual I was at the time. I mean, I had ministered. I was zonked. There was nothing left. I hurt. And if he wanted to be saved, he could get saved tomorrow. You could do it. Anybody but me. Just let me off the hook, God, please. I'm just trying to turn the light off. But his little wife was crying. I couldn't turn her down. I told her I'd talk to him. And he came in and he presented me with what he considered to be the absolutely unanswerable question. And when he started telling me the question, it sounded pretty good. And I thought, well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. But as soon as his mouth shut up, I told him the answer instantly. And it devastated him, devastated me, devastated a Christian brother that's a PhD at the University of Texas, El Paso, brilliant scientist, wrote a refutation of Einstein's theory. But you know what? He told me he had three questions. The answer so devastated him, he hung his head. He was an arrogant, proud peacock when he walked in before me. Little bitty short guy, Napoleonic complex. But when I told him this answer, and it was such a stupidly simple answer,